Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masterson. Today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the unfolding nuclear catastrophe in Japan and speak with Gordon Thompson, the Executive Director of the Institute for Resource and Security Studies, who is an expert on the environmental and security impacts of nuclear technologies. Then we'll be joined by a leading authority on the generation and delivery of power to large populations, David S. Freeman, the former head of the Tennessee Valley Authority, New York Power, and the LA Department of Water and Power. He was also the state of California's energy czar. We will look into the future of nuclear power in America and the available alternatives, if indeed this latest accident reverses President Obama's promise of $36 billion in loan guarantees for new nuclear plants. Then finally, we'll talk with a former Libyan diplomat who was a translator for Colonel Muammar Gaddafi. Dr. Abubakar Saad joins us to discuss the consequences of a possible victory of Gaddafi's forces and what can be done to prevent that from happening, along with the further slaughter of civilians in Libya. I'm now joined by Gordon Thompson, who is the Executive Director of the Institute for Resource and Security Studies in Cambridge, Massachusetts. He's also a research professor at Clark University's George Perkin Marsh Institute. On his one of his major interests has been the environmental and security impacts of nuclear technologies. Welcome to Background Briefing, Gordon Thompson.
Thank you. Good evening.
Good evening. And at this point, there has been a third explosion at the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear complex, this involving number two reactor. So we already have had number one blow up, I believe, on Saturday, number three blow up on Monday, and now apparently number two has blown up. And a spokesperson for the Tokyo Electric Power Company, TEPCO, said that this number two is even worse than the other units. So what's the latest information that you have, Gordon Thompson?
Well, information is sketchy and conflicting, but it appears there's significant core damage at each of the three units you mentioned. The release of radioactive material at present is quite small compared to the amount contained in the reactors.
So at this point, the explosions are caused by the hydrogen, which I understand is comes from the fact that the metal cladding around the fuel rods is melting, and this is a byproduct. But that would indicate already a level of meltdown is underway at all three.
That's correct. The fuel cladding is made of zirconium metal, which reacts vigorously with steam at high temperature and produces hydrogen gas. So the fact that this large amount of hydrogen gas exists demonstrates that the fuel has become substantially overheated, and it's likely that some of it has melted. The hydrogen was released first from the reactor vessel into the containment vessel which surrounds it, and was then released into the reactor building and exploded.
Well, apparently at the Fukushima plant, the operator, Tokyo Electric Power Company, have said that the fuel rods in the number two reactor had been exposed when water levels suddenly dropped due to an engine-powered pump pouring in the water that ran out of fuel. I mean, it's almost incomprehensible given the gravity of the situation that that kind of Murphy's Law could still be in play.
Well, if that is indeed the case, then that suggests a degree of disorganization that's a little surprising. But as I mentioned at the beginning, information is fragmentary and conflicting. So it won't be till after all of the dust has settled and there's a full inquiry that we'll know exactly what happened.
But we can assume, I imagine, Gordon Thompson, that given the exposure of the cores at these three reactors, that working on site is hazardous. And if you're pouring seawater and boric acid in, that would apparently corrode the instrumentation for the on-site monitoring. So it seems to me that there are two serious degrading factors here. One, the extent to which manpower can be on site to deal with it, and two, the damage to instrumentation.
Yes, you are exactly correct on both of these points. I imagine the site is highly disorganized. I'm sure it's very, very tense. The water is being supplied by portable pumps and perhaps fire trucks. Everything is irregular. This is an industry that normally goes by the book. There are detailed procedures for doing everything. The water that's used in these plants is purified to an extreme degree. So the fact that they're using seawater at all is symptomatic of the fact that the entire culture has been thrown into complete disarray. And I'm sure that the operators are groping for their next step. They've really gone to the limit of any procedure that would have been rehearsed.
And Gordon Thompson, the number three reactor apparently is fueled, it burns mixed oxide fuel, MOX, which contains plutonium. So if there's any release from that one, then surely that has serious consequences.
Well, the consequences would be serious if a release occurred from any of these reactors. You're correct that unit number three has some MOX fuel, some plutonium-containing MOX fuel. And if there is a release, there would be some greater consequences as a result of the MOX fuel.
And what do we know about the state of emergency that was declared yesterday at another plant at Onagawa? I haven't heard anything since yesterday.
Yes, I don't have information on Onagawa. I have a fair amount of information about Fukushima Daiichi.
Is there anything more you can share there? Because I think information is often hard to find in the midst of an ongoing catastrophe.
Yes, well, there are lots of general lessons about the nuclear industry, and perhaps it's best to address those lessons once this incident is resolved one way or another. But the incident could continue for weeks. The cores of these reactors produce heat that declines slowly but still will be significant for many days to come. So we may not see a quick resolution.
And what about the general assurances that the proponents of nuclear power give about built-in redundancy? It just seems on the surface a little hard to believe that in a country with a history of earthquakes and tsunamis, that these backup facilities would have been knocked out so easily.
Well, that actually raises a fundamental point about this industry, which is that the designs are, shall we say, optimized at a cost level that the industry feels is reasonable from their perspective. So there are always design options that could provide a greater level of safety, but the industry has chosen what it believes is a cost-effective design, and the regulators have accepted this as a design with an acceptable level of risk. So what we're seeing is a set of circumstances that go beyond the design envelope for these plants. In the jargon of the industry, what we're seeing is a set of beyond design basis events. So the plants were simply not designed for events of this nature.
And there are 31 similar plants in the United States, I believe, to this GE design light water reactor at Fukushima.
Of a roughly comparable design, that is correct.
Which goes back to the 1960s.
Indeed, yes.
So this I suppose an example of what you just told us, to Gordon Thompson, is apparently that the venting that's underway of the steam that is radioactive, the Europeans and the Scandinavians apparently have installed filters in such an eventuality that would filter out radioactive particulates under these circumstances. And apparently the U.S. and Japan and other countries have decided, the utilities have decided that's too expensive.
Yes, some reactors do have filtered venting pathways. However, there is no commercial nuclear reactor anywhere in the world that has a containment designed to accommodate a core melt accident. So plants vary in their ability to withstand a core melt accident, and to some extent they can be retrofitted to improve their capability in this respect, and some of them have been. But none of them were designed from the beginning for that purpose.
And that sounds rather extraordinary. And what would the reason for that be, or is that technically too high a bar?
No, it's perfectly possible. It's partly a question of cost, and it's partly that this is a very conservative industry, and also that many people in the industry believe that accidents are very rare and essentially almost impossible events. So there have been many regulatory proceedings where industry has fought very hard to continue using their original designs. And to some extent, regulators have fought back and demanded modifications, but only to a limited extent. And we're really seeing the outcome of that process now.
Well, that sounds, of course, with the benefit of hindsight, absolutely extraordinary that there are technical means available to prevent the worst possible outcome. And we had a partial meltdown at Three Mile Island, a full one at Chernobyl, various other smaller incidents in the earlier years of nuclear power. And now this one, that's where three nuclear reactors are in various stages of meltdown, and we're not quite sure of how grave it is in all three cases, except that we're told that the latest one that just exploded, number two, is worse than number one and number three. I'm just stunned that that's the case.
Well, just a little anecdote to illustrate. Alvin Weinberg was one of the pioneers of the nuclear industry in the United States. He worked with Admiral Rickover to develop submarine propulsion reactors, and then for many years headed the Oak Ridge National Laboratories. And around 1980 or so, Weinberg decided that if there was to be a new generation of nuclear power, the plant should be redesigned to have a much higher level of safety and a much greater a degree of resistance to malevolent actions as well.
You mean like terrorist attacks and things like that?
Indeed, yes. He put a fair amount of effort around that time, about 30 years ago, to try and convince the industry to go in this direction, and was essentially ignored.
And, of course, this is an industry that wouldn't exist in the first place but for the Price-Anderson Act that indemnifies nuclear power utilities in any accident and puts the burden on the taxpayer.
Well, that's correct. This industry would not exist in a totally free market situation.
Well, I thank you for joining us here today in Los Angeles, Gordon Thompson.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Gordon Thompson, who directs this Institute for Resource and Security Studies, and he is also his research and expertise is in the environmental and security impacts of nuclear technology. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking with one of the leading experts in the world on the generation delivery of power to large populations, David Freeman.
Hiroshima, Nagasaki, Alamogordo, Bikini. I'm going to preach you all a sermon about old man Adam. I don't mean the Adam in the Bible, Adam. I don't mean the Adam that Mother Eve made it. I mean the thing that science liberated. The thing that Einstein says he's scared of. And when Einstein's scared, brother, I'm scared.
Well, I don't know, but I've been told uranium ore's worth more than gold. Sold my cad, I bought me a Jeep. I got that bug and I can't sleep.
Uranium fever has gone and got me down. Uranium fever is spreading all around. With a Geiger counter in my hand,
I'm going out to take me some government.